From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park Podcast, Oral History Special, Number 6. Patricia Johnston's idyllic childhood in Rangoon came to an abrupt end on the 7th of December 1941 with the attack on Pearl Harbor. In early 1942, with the Japanese invasion getting ever closer, she was flown out with her siblings and arrived in India without her parents. After settling her two brothers in boarding school, Patricia's war really began. She realized after completing her training that nursing wasn't really for her, and transferred to the recently formed Women's Auxiliary Corps. Following a first posting in a camouflage school and receiving a commission, her link to Bletchley Park began when she joined an SLU unit as an intelligence officer. Based at military command posts around the world, special liaison units received ultra reports via secure links run by special communications units. They then passed this intelligence directly on to the commanders in the field to ensure the ultra secret was protected. Oral history volunteer Mike Chapman and Pat travel back 75 years to map out not only Pat's wartime service, but also that of her husband and fellow Bletchley Park veteran, Bill Sanglier. We hear of her embarrassment of paying school fees with damp money, the Japanese pilot she said a prayer for, how an infamous Cold War Russian spy was taught to cook curry by Pat's mother, and how working in military intelligence could at times feel like living in cloud cuckoo land.
This is Mike Chapman, oral history interviewer volunteer for the Bletchley Park Museum. It is Saturday, the 12th of October, 2019, and I'm at the home of one of our veterans, Pat Johnston, in the village of Weedon, just outside Aylesbury. So if we can hand over to you, Pat, if you could just say your name, and it would be useful if you could tell us about your link to Bletchley Park.
My name is Patricia Johnston. At the time that I first worked with the outstation of Bletchley Park, I was known as Patricia Rourke. That was my maiden name. My first knowledge of Bletchley Park was when I worked for the Western Wireless Subcentre. We were working on intercepts from Japanese planes. Then I was recommended for a commission, and I went up to an officer cadet training unit in the north of India. And when I was commissioned, I was posted down to General Headquarters in New Delhi to the Signals Intelligence Department. And I then became an intelligence officer for a special liaison unit outside New Delhi. The work at the time was very secret. We had to pretend we knew nothing, which was quite easy to do because I didn't think we knew all that much anyway.
Let's go back to the beginning. So what year were you born in?
I was born 1923.
Where were you born?
Rangoon.
In Burma?
Yes.
So you went to school in Rangoon?
Yes, very nice school. The Methodist English Girls High School. It was an American Methodist foundation. Very well run. Of course, English was the main language of the school. We had girls of every nationality. A lot of the Asian families were very progressive. They wanted their daughters educated, and they wanted them educated in an English school. There were no other schools to educate girls. The Burmese, Pongji Chowns as they were called, only educated boys.
Yeah.
So the Burmese girls didn't get a look in, but they did in the mission schools, and very clever, bright girls they were too, I might tell you.
Did you have any brothers and sisters at school with you as well? Or?
Yes, my eldest sister,
right,
who incidentally lives here in the village, she became a senior editor in the United Nations in the fullness of time.
Yes.
And I had two brothers and a younger sister. The elder of the two boys was in the RAF, and he was killed in an air exercise in Germany. That was very sad. He was very handsome. He really looked good in his RAF uniform.
Yes.
I stayed, did the full course up to what was called the 10th standard. And then I got a place in Rangoon University.
You were 18 then, were you?
17 and a half. I was 18 when once I was in university. I was going to read maths, very hopefully.
So you started university?
And I didn't finish it.
Right.
It all came to an abrupt end with Pearl Harbor. It happened overnight.
Yes.
I was in college. You've never seen anything empty so fast. Pearl Harbor was bombed. Monday morning, the university shut, and parents came from everywhere and removed all their students. And I think they were right to do so, because the Japanese bombed Rangoon for the first time on the 23rd of December. And then on the 25th of December was the second air raid. They flew up and down, machine gunning the streets. There was very little air defence. So my father came down at once, collected my sister and I. The younger ones were in boarding school in the north of Burma. And that's the last time I saw Rangoon. I went again to visit in 83, but that was the last break with my childhood. It was very sad, actually. I'll tell you, one of the saddest moments of my life was standing on the steps of Benton Hall, which was the girls' residence, and watching my friend, really good friend, Lillian Kondo, Japanese, being collected by the police. Now, there's a happy ending to this, because the Japanese families were collected up. They sent them all to India, so they escaped all the problems in Burma. And my sister, my older sister, when she was in Karachi, saw somebody in a rickshaw who waved out to her, and it was Lillian Kondo. And the British have to have their minds examined. What was she doing to earn a living? She was working in the British School of Intelligence. Now, I'm sorry. I laughed over this so often. Are we gullible? Are we trusting? Or is it that we really do have a measure of mankind? And I'm glad for her. I would have hated to think that very, very nice young woman, her life had come to an end. Would have been awful. Now, I think I've gone astray, haven't I?
No, you haven't. You're telling it beautifully. So you've had to leave university.
Yep.
Your dad came and collected you, your sister.
That's right.
What happened then? Did you have to leave the country?
Eileen, immediately, my elder sister, immediately joined up with the hospital and was ultimately brought out safely to India with the hospital. My mother, I said, what do you want me to do? I don't want to be a nurse. She said, will you take the three younger ones to India? The army were taking us all out and put them in boarding school. And here's lots of money sewed into a belt. She put it around me. And we'll meet you in India at some point. The army was so good. They really were good. They looked after everybody.
Mm.
We had one hairy moment. As we were loading up the plane, the DC-3, it came across with troops, and all the troops came out of the plane, and the refugees, evacuees, whatever you want to call them, were loaded into the plane. There was a sound of a plane. It was a Japanese plane. We were there in the middle of the airfield with the aircraft. People with their bags, etc. That Japanese plane flew low over us, so low we could see the pilot. We almost could make eye contact with him. He circled slowly round. We all followed him around with our eyes, not knowing what's going to happen, because they had already attacked a station. He did nothing. He went all the way round. And he tipped his wing and he flew away.
Good.
And I said a prayer for him that night because he could have machine gunned us. He could have destroyed that plane. He could have created carnage and he did nothing. He just flew away. I've always thought that was a story worth telling. I wonder who he was. and what his report was when he flew back to the airfield from which he came.
Yeah.
We've flown out, we've put up in Calcutta, in Fort William, and from there we all went our own way.
How did your mum and dad get out?
My father walked out. It took him nearly a month. He was a sight when he arrived. He's almost unrecognisable. He was so thin, and he'd gone white, grey-haired, because the monsoons broke as they were walking out of Burma through the jungles. See, there was no roads between Burma and India at that time. It was just jungle.
Right.
And when the monsoons broke, the streams become torrents, and it just does not stop. And what is even worse is the leeches. They come out from everywhere. Heaven knows where leeches live before the rains start. But once the rain starts, horrible, they make my blood curdle.
Yeah.
But he walked out safely. But sadly, an awful lot of people died.
Right. And your mother got out safely?
Mummy flew out.
Right.
She flew out from Lashio in a Chinese plane. The Chinese were not evacuating people in a spirit of saving them. They had to pay for their fares.
Mm.
Well, why not?
Yeah. You arrived in Calcutta.
Yes.
Your two brothers, sounds like they were sent to boarding school.
Well, I took them. I put the boys in school. I put my sister in boarding school. I take my hat off to the headmaster of the boys' school. I don't think in all his life he was ever paid by a young 18-year-old in cash. I hadn't had time to go by bank, and I hope he didn't notice that all the notes were slightly damp because I'd worn them around my waist. And once I got the children in schools, then I went back down into Dehradun, and I joined up in the military hospital as an auxiliary nurse.
Right.
And from then on, till I married, before I left India, I paddled my own canoe.
So you were an auxiliary nurse. They trained you.
Yes.
Was it a military hospital? Or
it was a military hospital, but I didn't like nursing. And after the five-month training, I was free to do what I wanted, sign on permanently or not. Mm. But the Women's Auxiliary Corps had just been started in India, and I thought that would suit me more. So I resigned as a nurse. I joined the Women's Auxiliary Corps. I became the dispatch clerk in a camouflaged school. Very interesting.
Yes. What did that involve then?
Designing camouflage for units. They sent representatives from various units that were working in the front to find out ways of camouflaging their equipment and things.
Oh.
That's right. We had one very exciting moment. We were told that a ship was coming into Bombay, and on it was going to have something called docks, amphibious craft.
Yeah.
Right. These amphibious docks were to be delivered secretly into India. They were for use in Burma and hopefully in time in Malaya. Right. They were going to come into a ship in the harbour, and we had to find some way to camouflage them. So I was only the dispatch clerk, so I was not involved in designing this camouflage. But everybody was thrilled to bits to have something active to do. And they were terribly pleased with their ideas of how to camouflage this craft. Well, you know, the ways of mice and men don't always work out. The ship that was delivering this craft was too big to come in dockside.
Right.
So what they did is they lured the ducks over the side of the ship, and the ducks paddled their way in from the ship to the shore while the whole of Bombay hung over the edges and watched them come in. All that camouflage was a waste. It was the highlight of Bombay's weekend.
Yeah. Crikey. So this is 1942. So how long were you there for?
Only for, 6 months.
Right.
My two brothers, my younger sister, were moved by my mother from their school in North India down to a place called Bangalore. And my sister, who was a nurse, applied for a place in the hospital in Bangalore. So I asked the army if they would find me a job in Bangalore.
Right.
And so I left the Camp Lodge school and went down and worked at a place called Western Wireless Sub-Centre. And our job was monitoring Japanese call signs from the aircraft. There were three units, one in Bangalore, one in Trincomalee, I think was in Ceylon, Vizagapatam was the third. Triangulation. We were able to pinpoint where the Japanese planes were coming from.
Right.
Whether they were based on shore or on an aircraft carrier. I didn't see the end product of anything. My job was just to record all the call signs.
So what would happen? Somebody would give you a list or the signals?
No, we had a set room where these men all sat monitoring call signs. They would send all the bearings that they had.
Yes.
To us. We would catalogue them all, send them all off, and there would be the same call signs were being monitored by a unit in Vizag and a unit in Trincomalee, and that's right. They were able to pinpoint where the Japanese planes were flying from.
So you said you're recording something. What are you recording onto? Is it sheets of paper? Was it a book? Was it a card?
We only got the forms. They had a set room. And all these men were there. They recorded everything, sent them all to us, and we got them catalogued so that they're in readable form.
Did you have any training for that? Or did they just put you to work?
Put us to work.
Right.
And used our native intelligence to bridge the gap. It worked. That's all that mattered.
Yes. So what do you remember about Bangalore?
Very pleasant memories. Bangalore was not affected by the war. The only way in which it was affected is that both the British and the Americans used it as a relief centre for their various troops. Mm. And there was I suppose it was a big restaurant with an upstairs ballroom called Funnels, which was, in my memory, just a place that bristled with Americans and British on leave. Well, they had to come somewhere, poor men.
Mm.
But it was surprising. I couldn't believe that they would send men. After all, the fighting was up on the Burmese front, up on the Assam front. And Bangalore was right down in South India. And yet they sent these men all that way to go on leave. I suppose the men probably were given an option as to where they wanted to go. But it was really good because it took them right away from the war.
Yes. So were you in uniform?
Yes.
Right.
I started out as a private dispatch clerk. I finished up as a captain, which is a junior commander, as an intelligence officer. That suited me best.
So what sort of accommodation did you have in Bangalore?
Ah, the YW ran a hostel, so I had a room. And they ran it for officers. And by then I was an officer.
Yeah.
So I was pretty comfortable.
So you went all the way from private to an officer while at Bangalore?
No, I first went to this officer cadet training unit.
Right.
I set off as a private. I came down into a job with three pips.
So
it was quite exciting.
I'm trying to work this out. You're at Bangalore.
Yes.
And
then I got...
You started as a private.
Yeah, I became a sergeant.
You became a sergeant.
Then I applied for a commission.
Right.
And I went up to the OCTU in North India in a place called Dagshai. I was commissioned. I went down to New Delhi. When I got down to New Delhi, I was sent as an intelligence officer to a special liaison unit.
Okay, so coming back then on to Bangalore, because we haven't exhausted that subject yet, because I reckon there's probably more you can remember. So you're in Bangalore. What's the food like? Can you remember?
Oh, splendid. There was no rationing in India. We had a good cook.
Do you remember how much you were paid?
I really don't. Partly my finances got a bit entangled because my elder sister, she was a brilliant student. She had 2 scholarships in the university, all thrown away. She became a nurse for the war, and she was working in the Bowring General Hospital in Bangalore. So I financed her. There was something nice. It made a bond between my sister and I, but it was a bond between us because we felt we were saving Mummy and Daddy from any problems as far. We stuck together. We helped each other out whenever needed. We still help each other out.
How big was the unit down in Bangalore? Can you remember?
Well, it was called a sub-centre, but we had 4 different units all under in one compound.
Right.
But the little one group that I worked with, we had our wing commander. I was a sergeant, 5 girls. But we were the kind of clerical unit.
Yeah.
There were 4 other units around. They sent us all their desk work to do, which was really why we were there.
Were you working normal sort of daytime hours then, presumably?
That's right.
Whereas the others would have been working shifts.
They were all resident. All the men were resident.
Yes.
It's only us group of girls. We were picked up in the morning by a 300-weight truck, and they gave us lunch and drove us home in the evening.
Right.
And we had to wait around. Oh, how we had to wait around. Because our CO also lived in Bangalore. He decided to live in a hotel with his wife. Don't ask me. It's a mystery I've never solved. He was a vet. He had a veterinary practice in Madras. What he was doing as our boss? I tell you.
No idea.
The ways of this army is mysterious. But he was a delightful man.
Right. So how many, roughly, was it 100, couple of hundred, 500, 1,000, do you think?
Well,
in total at Bangalore in this single
unit? Nothing like that. I can bring most of their faces up to my mind.
Right.
I would say there were no more than 30.
30.
40.
30 or 40. Right. Mm. So quite a small team.
Yeah, because we were separate teams. There was B group, that's inter-service wireless group. They were a very small little group. The set room boys were all attached to BISW. There was a small naval section whom we never got to grips with. They never used us. All the other sections used us girls for typing. We never got a sniff as to what this small naval unit were there for. I mean, Bangalore's miles away from the sea. So I reckon, looking back, that they were a small unit who received intelligence to send out to the Navy.
Yeah.
Must be. But that's guesswork.
So you think this was all about tracking of aircraft?
This was all tracking, monitoring where ships were, where aircraft were, and any other things that could be picked up on the wireless. Because the set room was all wireless lads with, as I say, headphones.
So we'd call that today, I think, traffic analysis from the way that you've described it.
Yeah.
Was there any code breaking going on there that you're aware of?
No, not that I'm aware of at all. But, of course, when I went up to Delhi, it was quite different. The SLU was all about codes.
Yes.
We had our machine.
When you were in Bangalore, were you aware of any achievements, any particular significant things that they were involved with that anybody let them know about?
Not really. It was very, very, what you know, you don't tell the person in the desk next to you. I think security was very good. That's my feeling about what happened in the war. The right hand did not really know what the left hand was doing.
So these Japanese aircraft, did you have any idea where they were operating?
They were operating off aircraft carriers in the Bay of Bengal.
Right.
Yeah.
Where were they attacking? Have you got any idea?
They attacked 1 or 2 places along the coast. They weren't very successful at all. I don't think Colombo in Ceylon was ever attacked by them.
Right.
They never came in as far inland as Bangalore.
So you got promoted to sergeant, you applied for a commission, you went to the training college.
Mm-hmm.
They made you an officer.
Yes.
Was there lots of saluting, drill and all that sort of thing?
Not really.
No?
Not really. You didn't salute anybody who didn't have on a cap.
Right.
To start with.
Right.
And, you know, we bypassed each other so much during the day, you couldn't go on saluting forever.
Right.
The atmosphere was very good. That's one thing I will say. I don't know what it was like here in England for girls, but they did have a problem in India, insomuch as a lot of the girls who were in the Women's Auxiliary Corps came from families where their father was an official somewhere, right, or was a high-ranking army officer, and that was very hard. I would not like to be a man who's got to discipline a girl when you know her father's 2-3 ranks above you.
Indeed. Indeed.
Not a comfortable situation.
No. I think you said you went to New Delhi next.
Yes.
Right.
And I went straight to an SLU.
So for the benefit of anybody listening to this, can you remember what SLU stood for?
Special Liaison Unit.
Right. I haven't asked you, how long was your training as an officer?
I think it was only 3 weeks.
3 weeks, right. Mm. Did they give you any specific training before you joined the SLU on what that was about?
No. I think the Officer Cadet Training Unit didn't even know what an SLU was.
Right.
They were only concerned in turning us out as top grade snobbers, I felt, which I was not. A lot of the girls went straight into office work, etc. But I was lucky. I came straight out and I became an intelligence officer along with a group of men.
Yeah. Can you remember roughly when you arrived in New Delhi? Would have been 1944, I think, wouldn't it, on the basis of what you've said so far?
1944. Yeah.
1944. End of 1944. Because how long were you at Bangalore for?
Let's see, we came out of Burma in 42, early 42. Then I was in the camouflage school the whole of 42. April 43, I went down to Bangalore. So 2 years, roughly, in Bangalore.
2 years in Bangalore. Right. Were you told this stuff was secret?
Oh, yes.
Was there any formality around that? Anything you had to sign or anything of that sort?
We had to sign the Official Secrets Act. But automatically, if you're in the army, you were expected not to talk.
Yes.
Whoever you were.
Yeah.
Signing the Official Secret Act was just stamping something that was accepted anyway.
So you were in an SLU. Was there a number with that SLU? SLU 1, 2, 3, 4,
no,
5,
just
6?
SLU.
Just SLU.
There was an SLU in New Delhi. There was an SLU in 14th Army. And there was an SLU in SEAC, that Southeast Asia Command, in Ceylon.
What was the work that your SLU did? Can you describe it?
Well, it was dealing with intercepts, passing them on. We were used as a kind of clearinghouse for intelligence. It was sent to us from Bletchley. We had specially trained, they were men, and they were the RAF, who operated the Type X. Whatever information we collected was not our business as to where it was sent.
These men who were in the RAF, were they SLU as well, or were they in a different unit? Can you remember?
No, they were in the SLU, but they were RAF.
Right.
My husband, who was just one of the officers who I married in the end.
Right.
He was a kind of roving intelligence officer. He went off to set up an arrangement for Slim in 14th Army to receive whatever stuff we got that was relevant to him. They went off with one of these machines where everything was coded and what have you.
Yes.
When the focus of the war shifted to Malaya, my bill was sent down to do the same thing for Louis Mountbatten. He said he found Mountbatten very disconcerting. When he worked for Slim, he said he would take stuff across. He'd carry them in, he'd stand and he'd salute him. And Slim was very proper, very nice man.
Yeah.
He said he really liked working for him, but it was all official, very official. He'd give them stuff, he'd salute and he'd walk out. When he got down to Sia with Louis Mountbatten, he said to me, What do you do when the Supremo comes in? You salute him and he sits on the edge of your desk.
That's a bit unusual.
I know. He said he would just come in and he'd sit on the end. He said he was a tall man. He'd perch himself there and say to him, "Now, what, anything special?"
Quite an informal man.
Yeah, Bill thought both Slim and Mountbatten were the epitome of what a British officer should be. He liked working for them because they accepted the difference in command, but weren't oppressive. They were officers and gentlemen, quite simply, and he liked working for both of them. It's a sideways glance at two very important men.
Very, very interesting. So we'll come on to your husband in a minute,
because
we haven't got anything. He's not on the roll of honour,
no.
So we need to get as much detail as we can about him.
Right.
So we're back at New Delhi again, and we're back with you. So you've arrived. You're an intelligence officer, I think you've said.
Yes.
New Delhi for the SLU.
Yes.
And I think you've said you were handling the intercepts.
Yes.
And you were handling the intelligence that came in. So thinking first about those intercepts, can you remember anything about those? Where were they coming from?
When we were in Bangalore, the intercepts, a lot of them were coming from Japanese planes.
Right.
And a lot of them were coming from shipping. When we were in New Delhi, some of the intercepts were coming from diplomatic channels which were being bugged. I know, and I never found out why, but there was a source somewhere in Persia that supplied us with stuff.
Right.
And stuff from somewhere in Afghanistan. But what they were, well, you see, this was the trouble. It's very hard to ask somebody to rake their memories when they've had to work in a pocket, you know?
Yes.
We were forced to work in pockets for security's sake.
Yeah.
We were told not to gossip between ourselves.
Yeah.
No good saying to somebody, "Fancy what I had this morning." You know, what came across my desk? That was discouraged.
So let me ask some questions then about these intercepts.
Yes.
So they came into you. Can you remember how they came to you? Did they come to you teleprinter? Was it by dispatch rider? Was it
post?
They
were the Wireless Experimental Centre, which was outside New Delhi. You've no doubt got some record of them. They received all the messages. They sent it across to us from Korea.
Right.
We didn't do the intercepting. They did.
They did.
They sent the stuff to us to handle and disseminate.
So these intercepts, you actually could read them, you could see them?
Oh, yes. They were plain type when they came to
Plain text when they came to you. Right.
WEC had all the means of reading Japanese codes and what have you. There were departments alongside departments. Most of them didn't know who was doing what.
Right.
Had to be that way.
Yeah. Can you remember what sort of thing any of these messages contained?
Now, let's think. I know there was somebody who used to send stuff which of the value of which I was unable to understand. This is the one somewhere in Persia who was sending us stuff which we had to send on. It's very hard. You see, at the time you're told to read and forget, and there was such a lot. So unless you were a spy, you read and forgot.
Right. Were these long messages?
Varied. You know, somebody had quite a lot to say, and others would just say something like reporting air traffic or troop movements or something.
Right. So the messages came to you from the Wireless Experimentation Centre, and you passed them on to...
To Bletchley, really. We were...
Oh, you passed them to Bletchley?
We had two-way. But as you see, I didn't operate any of the machines.
No.
I had a go for the fun of it.
Right.
Very hard not to.
Yes.
It's this very interesting machine. But mostly what I did is I sat at a desk. I got all this bump. I organised it, catalogued it, read and forget.
Right. So the messages would come to you and your desk.
Yep.
You'd catalogue it, if I've understood you correctly. Some would then be sent over to Bletchley.
Yeah.
And some would go to...
Some would come from Bletchley.
You said you were part of GHQ, so General Headquarters. Was that where you were passing them on to?
I'm not quite... Now, you've got to excuse me on this. You've no idea how tight the security was. And this business of discouraging you from talking, you got used to it. The only time it's ever affected me, I found no problem whatever. I didn't want to say fancy. I just was not of that mind. Yeah. And I rather think that that's why those of us who worked together because we had been selected because we were not of that mind. We knew how to keep a still tongue.
But what I'm trying to understand is you've got messages coming from the experimentation centre.
Yep.
So that's local intercepts, local code breaking, if I've understood correctly.
Yeah. Some things that were marked for Viceroy only or for General so-and-so only.
Right.
For that, we had a courier.
Ah, right. So the messages would come to you from the WEC.
That's right.
Or they'd come to you from Bletchley Park.
Yeah.
Some of them, if I've understood you correctly, would be sent to Bletchley. So the WEC ones would go to Bletchley. And then some of them you would send to the Viceroy, General somebody or other.
General Sim, yeah.
Right. And can you remember how those were sent?
When we were in Delhi, we had a courier. It used to amuse me. He would set off on a bicycle with top secret things in his pocket to go and deliver them to the Americans. Do you know, occasionally I used to feel I was living in cloud cuckoo land. Because in the back of my mind was saying, all this is vital to the war effort.
Yeah.
This is vital information. It's going to be acted on, etc. Then you look around your fellow people who are sitting around you. And one of them is the heir to a big catering firm in London. And another one of them has a telescope because he's fascinated by the night skies. And he turns up in the morning and says, do you know Jupiter was such and such? No.
Do you remember any of the names?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. We had a Frankie Lyon. There was, let me think, a man by the name of Hirsch. He was a school teacher. And somebody else whose name is something Carberry. Both Hirsch and Carberry were older than us. They're both school teachers.
Yes. You've got these messages. They've come in. Some of them are going to Bletchley. Some of them are going to the local command or viceroy or generals or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's the intercepts. You also said you had the intelligence. So that's what's coming in from Bletchley Park.
Yeah, that's right. Which we had to pass on.
Which you had to pass on. So when you say you were doing cataloguing, what do you mean by cataloguing?
We get a mass of stuff coming in from the set room. There were endless intercepts.
Right.
And we noted them all down.
Right.
And we tidied them up.
Right. Those messages that went to the Viceroy or went to a general or went to other intelligence people, did you have any responsibility from them once they left your room?
No.
None at all. They were gone.
They were gone.
Did any of them have any sort of set destruction dates or anything of that sort?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Right.
We were merely a post office, in my opinion.
You said you started this in, was it late 44 or early 1945, roughly?
Yes.
So can you remember the camp that you were working in? Can you remember very much about it?
Not an awful lot. There had been a big building there, and the camp had all grown up around it.
Right.
There were quarters, you know, there were hutments, we call them.
Hutments?
Hutments.
Right. Okay.
Huts that were thrown together in a hurry to make a kind of ballet.
Right. I haven't heard that phrase, but I can see how it works.
Yes.
So you're in these hutments. Where was your accommodation?
When I went to New Delhi, I got married. And then we lived in a flat because my husband worked the same work as I was doing.
So in that case, then, we better talk about that side of it, so we can bring him in properly.
Yeah.
So you met Bill...
In Bangalore.
In Bangalore.
That's right. And then he was posted off to work for Slim on the Burma front. And then from 14th Army, he went back just about 5 minutes to base, which was SLU in New Delhi.
Yes.
And then he was posted down to supply special intelligence to Mountbatten.
In Ceylon.
That's right. That was SEAC, Southeast Asia Command headquarters.
So when was this happening then?
This is all happening in 45, I think. Yeah, early 45. Susan had born 46, yes, early 45.
So you'd been in a proper camp and they just moved you into this hut in the grounds of the governor's residence?
Around the corner was all this secret stuff going on. And you opened the door and walked in, because it said outside headquarters.
Yeah.
Went up to this desk with a flap.
Yeah.
With a bell on it. And you banged on it, ping, and somebody came round the corner and said yes. And if you were acceptable, you were let in. If you weren't, you were shown on your way. No, this was halfway through. Don't try and unravel it. They'd drive you mad.
I'm getting confused now.
So am I.
You met Bill April 1943 when you were at Bangalore.
Yes, that's right.
And what was his rank? Can you remember?
He was lieutenant.
Lieutenant, right. And what had he done before that?
He went out to India with 2nd Div, and he was their codes and ciphers officer because he trained for codes and ciphers at Bletchley.
Right.
At the school. And then he was posted to 2nd Div.
Right. Do you know which regiment he was in?
2 Div it was. Headquarters
at 2nd
Div.
Division.
Yeah.
Was he Intelligence Corps? Was he Royal Signals?
No, he was Company Sergeant Major.
That's fine, if you can't remember the regiment.
No, it was London Rifle Brigade is where he started.
Right.
When he was first conscripted or whatever it is.
Okay.
He was in the London Rifle Brigade.
Yeah.
And they recruited groups of men from all over the place to try and hunt down people who were guiding the Germans in with lights. So he was sent to Coventry. And in the air raids, they went out on patrol to try and find anybody who was signalling lights from their roofs.
And that's visual signalling. It's lights.
Watching for people who were
not
doing...
Not radio signalling.
No, no. He said it was quite exciting. One night, somebody tipped them off and they had to climb over the fences of several houses to find this house, which was signalling.
Incredible.
I think a lot of exciting things went on. He was attached to London Rifle Brigade then.
Just to sum up, he joined London Rifles, then recruited into this team that were working for... Sounds like MI5 trying to catch people in Coventry signalling to German aircraft. Then at some point he got recruited to go to Bletchley to be trained in the code and cipher operation, what we'd call signal intelligence
today. And then he was posted to 2nd Div as their cipher officer.
Right, and that was in India?
He went out with 2nd Div.
Right.
And 2nd Div, when it arrived in India... was their headquarters was in a place called Ahmedabad.
Yeah.
And while Bill was there, he was just sent for one morning and said, we've got to say goodbye to you. You've got a posting to New Delhi. So off he went to New Delhi, reported. He was a then company sergeant major.
Right.
He said it was an extraordinary interview. He walked in as a company sergeant major. He walked out with 2 pips in his hand. He said he felt in a daze. He had walked in as a sergeant major. He walked 2 pips. So he said he went to his hut, took off these stripes, he put the 2 pips up. He said all of a sudden he's an officer. When he got to India, he was commissioned into the 9th Jots. 9th Jots. J-A-T-S.
J-A-T-S.
A very old Indian regiment.
Yeah, was it?
Oh, yes.
So he went to New Delhi. He got converted from a CSM
to a
lieutenant.
Yeah, lieutenant in the 9th Jots.
In the 9th Jots. And then at some point then he went up to the border with Burma.
Yes.
With General Slim.
Yeah. But anyway, they were posted from the SLU to supply Slim with whatever information was relevant for him.
Right. So have you any idea when he moved from there to Ceylon with Mountbatten?
Now, all this happened in 1944, I think.
Right. And again, you're not sure when he was reporting to Mountbatten if he was SCU. So that might come out of your research with the MOD when you get his record.
Mm.
Well, that might just say that he was 9th Jarts. That's all
right.
We need to say.
Because when he came home, he was transferred into the intelligence corps because 9th
That's
Jarts,
when he came back into the
finally,
came back to the UK.
That's right. He was then posted to Paris.
Right.
And he worked for IS9.
Right. I'm still trying to keep this thread going. So
you'll never get it straight.
He went from New Delhi. He went up to the border
14th
working
Army.
For General Slim. Then he went down to Sri Lanka.
To Siak, yes.
To work
Southeast
for
Asia Command to work for Mountbatten.
Where did he go after? He must have gone then back to New Delhi.
He went back to New Delhi and he was our officer in charge.
Right. And that's when he hasn't gone to Bangalore. So how did he meet you?
He met me in Bangalore.
Right.
And on his way back from Ceylon, he stopped at Bangalore and we got engaged.
Right. And that was April Fool's Day, 1943.
No, later. That's when I first met him. Don't try and unravel this. I won't sleep tonight as I try and get...
Right, so he's come back to New Delhi.
Yeah.
And the two of you got married. And that was early 45.
That's right. And the end of 45, we came home.
Right. Before we jump forward to the end of 45 and you coming home.
Mm.
Let's go back then. 8th May 1945, Nazi surrender.
Yeah.
You were presumably aware.
Yes.
Did you notice any change in the volume of work
that
you had at that point?
Not really.
Not really.
The trouble was, I don't know, I suppose I can say so. We'd started doing diplomatic work as well.
Right.
We were being used. We were just a secure way of... Yeah. Sending messages. But I had left them. I wasn't feeling very well. And I applied for a job in Delhi. It was so hot. So right. New Delhi itself. And so I left the unit by the time the war actually ended.
When did you actually leave? Do you remember the date?
This is 1945.
Roughly. You were gone before VJ Day.
Oh, yes, I did. I left after VE Day.
VE Day.
But I was there for VJ Day.
What do you remember about VJ Day?
General feeling everywhere. Everybody feeling relaxed. Thank God.
Yeah.
That's the general feeling everywhere. I forget what we did. I think some of us all went out to dinner together.
Right.
To celebrate for VJ Day. We had a celebratory parade.
Right.
Oh, it was magnificent. You should have seen the Gurkhas. They came, they had a whole block of, all the way down Kingsway.
Yeah.
We had all these celebrities. Tallest of all is, what's his name, General, the great big tall one, Slim. Anyway, by then I was working in General Headquarters and I had a privileged seat. I was up on this platform.
Right. You're still a captain.
Yeah, junior commander.
Junior commander. What was Bill at this point in time?
He was a captain.
He was captain as well.
Yeah.
Right.
And, we were all captains, the ones who worked on the SLU. But this parade, have you been to Delhi?
No. I've been to Mumbai.
Well, Delhi has a long avenue. What used to be General Headquarters was one end. This beautiful long avenue.
Yeah.
And the other end. There was an old palace, Indian palace, but two archways on the way. And there was this parade. There were Americans, of course, our allies, all these dignitaries are on a platform to take the salute. Me in the background, merely because I was allowed to be there.
Yeah.
I watched this and they came up. But, you know, it was when the Gurkhas came. Everybody watched. There were Gurkhas with their hats, you know, all in blocks.
Yeah.
All came down. But the Gurkhas raised a cheer from everywhere. They were so popular.
Yeah.
And, you know, they look like little clones. They all look exactly alike. Yes. It's quite amazing. But it was a lovely day because the war was really over. When the war finished, when the war in Europe finished, and the war in Japan finished, I left the SLU. And for just those last handful of weeks before we came home, I was Identity Cards India. That's what it said on the the board outside my office. I hated that. You know why? Because the hospitals, etc., were all sending people home.
Yes.
And clearing up their records.
Yes.
They had so much to do. They were supposed to destroy identity cards of people who died and issue destruction certificates.
Yes.
They had too much on their hands. So they got in the habit of piling them all together and posting them back to source, to Identity Cards India. There's such small things that happen in war. I was young. I was full of life. I put it all behind me. But I can imagine that there are people who go through proper trauma. To me, this is peripheral.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can understand it haunting them for years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. So between VE Day and VJ Day, you left the SLU, and you worked for the identity card.
Yes.
That identity card.
That's right.
And what was Bill doing at this point?
He stayed with the SLU.
Right.
But then he was posted to Paris.
Right. So did you go home with him?
That's right. By then we were married, so we came home together.
Right.
And I stayed with his mother, because we didn't have a home here.
Yeah.
And Bill was posted to Paris, and his job was to go into all the villages and collect stories for awards. The department was called IS9 Awards, because they had to collect accurate stories before they could give awards.
Yes.
And one of the men, Jacques Vaterbled, wrote a book, and he sent Bill after the war a copy of his book, which Bill was delighted with. When we moved here, we cleared up a lot of stuff. And in amongst all the books we went this book. We were unable to claw it back. We tried to claw it back through the people we had given the books to.
Yes.
But they had already passed them on and sold them and stuff. And so we lost that book, which is such a pity.
Yeah.
Because this chap, Jacques Vaterbled, had been very brave. You know, he broke his legs or damaged them, jumping out of a window when he was working in a hotel as a cover. And the Germans came into the hotel and somebody tipped him off that the Germans had been tipped off about him. So he went to the back and he jumped out of one of the windows into a coal frame or something or the other and injured both his legs. However, he wrote a book. Bill said that after the war, when he was posted to Paris and they were in this IS9 Awards, they were chasing up the stories, he said the sheer relief that the war was over and all these people who had been doing undercover stuff could now talk about it.
Right.
He said mess nights were just one big boast. All eating and drinking and boasting.
Yes. Had he transferred to the intelligence corps by now?
Yes. When he came back, he had to transfer.
Right. So he was working for a building society.
Mm.
You were back here as well.
Mm.
Sounds like you had children.
Yep. Four.
Four. So you said it was all a bit normal after that. A bit regular, a bit routine.
Yeah.
Well, apart from the man, your father invented this device.
My father, who was a motor engineer,
and
Gordon Lonsdale
was going to fund it.
Was going to fund help the company that was going to manufacture it, and he needed cover. You see,
yes, and he turned out to be a Russian spy.
Yeah, it was my mother's reaction to Gordon Lonsdale. It was so funny.
Right.
She liked him, and she had taught him to make a curry.
Yes.
In her kitchen.
Yeah.
And they had chatted away. And then he turns out to be a spy.
Yes.
She was furious. Mummy said he was absolutely charming. She enjoyed his company so much.
Yes.
And that all added to her wrath when she found out he was a Russian spy. My poor brother. Now, he was working for the company that Lonsdale was using as a cover, which is really how, a roundabout way, he had gotten out. My brother had gone to this lunch, and he had drunk a bit. His car was outside, and he picked up the car to drive back to his office, did a U-turn in the road, and clipped the fence of a house. And immediately, the police were there. Tom said, because my brother Tom never short of conversation, he said, lucky for you that you happened to be here. Later on, the policeman, he said, wasn't lucky, you know.
Yeah.
We were trailing you because of that nonsense. How are we wasting your time?
No, no, you're not wasting my time. So I want to come back on the thread, though. So 1974-75... and the British government declassifying most of the information about the Bletchley Park operation.
And that book is published.
Yes. So what did you think? What did Bill think? What was your reaction to this book coming out?
Oh, very exciting, yes.
Very exciting.
Bought a copy.
So, 75, you were pleased. You said you were pleased. Your positive reaction to the news coming out.
Mm.
You can talk about it. Other people can talk about it.
That's right.
So you spoke to the children, you spoke to friends and family?
Not very much. You get used to being quiet. It was necessary to have it drilled into us that if we talked too freely, we would do tremendous damage.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I was saying, when you get used to not talking, you lose the urge to talk.
Yes. So what I want to do now, so I did a bit of research. What is important is that I don't feed you stuff as the interview's going on.
Good.
So we've just about got your non-fed, your memories. But what I want to do is just go through a few things to see if these mean anything to you. So you weren't actually part of the Wireless Experimental Centre?
No.
Pooney, you were separate to that?
We were separate.
And it was based at Ramjas College, which was on a hill called Anand Parasat. Does that mean anything to you?
Ananda Parbat.
I'm sorry, that's a B, not an IS. A man, and that wasn't a test. Ananda Parbat, right. So that means something to you.
Yeah.
How far away were you from there?
About 25 minutes
drive. 25 minutes, right. And I've got that in there, there was the Intelligence Corps, British Army, Indian Army, and also an RAF presence. Does that sound right?
I was not aware of the RAF.
Right.
Which was a very large setup.
Yeah. Looking online, about 1,000 people.
Mm.
1,000 people in the WEC.
And we only had our own small hut.
Right. You've mentioned diplomatic stuff.
Mm.
What about Soviet-Russian signals? Did you come across any of that?
Soviet-Russia didn't mean very much to us.
Right.
But the stuff that we did get from this source...
Which was Persia and Afghanistan.
That's right. We received it and passed it on, and it slipped out of our hands. We retained no record of it.
Right.
But we didn't retain a record of very much that we handled. We handled it, passed it on, and forgot it.
Right. So when you said there was diplomatic stuff and you said there was a source, so Bletchley Park famously was handling material that was decrypts from the Japanese naval attachés and the Japanese military attachés. So the best example that anybody talks about is the how the Germans would give them escorted tours of the gun emplacements, the beaches, the protection from Germany all the way down to coast of France and the Spanish border. And then the Japanese would happily send messages, the Japanese diplomatic, the embassy people would send messages back to Tokyo. And these were things like the concrete's this thick and the guns of this calibre and all this sort of stuff. And Bletchley Park was decrypting that. So that might have been some of the stuff. I've also seen reference to something called BULPUL, Bulpul, which was Imperial Japanese Army air-to-ground code. So communications between the Japanese Army and the aircraft above. And that work apparently was transferred from Bletchley Park. But that, I think, you wouldn't have necessarily known.
No.
Because that would have gone to the WEC, the Wireless Experimental Centre.
Yes.
They would have done the decrypts.
Yeah.
What you might then have got was the intelligence relating to that.
But remember, we had Typex.
Yes, which I would have thought was the stuff coming out of Bletchley Park.
Oh, yes.
There was WEC Abbottabad, which was Soviet. There was Bangalore, and there was also somewhere called Barrackpore.
Barrackpore. Yes. That's outside Calcutta.
This Section C, apparently, for the WEC, had various teams, including admin collating and evaluating SIGINT, which sounds a bit like what you were doing, but apparently not.
That's right. We used to have stuff marked collation.
Right.
To be sent to collation. And that's adding two and two to make four.
Apparently another thing that was going on was decryption of something called the water transport code, which puzzled me initially. But actually, when it says water transport code, that's not the transportation of water. That's transport on water. And that was monitoring shipping, which would sort of seem to match with some of the things. The last one I've got, I think you may have mentioned this, the Indian Wireless Intelligence Centre.
Yes, IWIS.
IWIS. You did mention that, didn't you?
Yes.
So that all matches.
That IWIS was in headquarters, yeah. New Delhi.
Right. So were you actually part of IWIS or you just worked with them?
IWIS worked alongside them.
Alongside them, right. If I said radio security service, would that mean anything to you at all? To do with Bill?
No.
Nothing at all. So the final question I think I have to formally ask you is, looking back on it now, how do you feel about your time in the war and the contribution that you made?
It was worth doing.
I think we'd all agree with that. I can't think of anything we've missed out. Is there anything, though, that you can think of which you think might be of interest or which you had expected to be asked or to talk about, which you'd like to add before we stop the tape?
Not really, because, see, I left, and so I was not around for the winding up of it.
So I think I'm going to shut this down.
Right.
So thank you very much, Pat. That was absolutely fantastic. You've remembered.
Thank you. I'm not sure.
An awful lot. You've given us a massive amount of material.
You think so?
I definitely do. I'm rather pleased it's not me who's going to have to do the transcript, because it takes about five times longer to convert that into words versus the tape. But it's been absolutely brilliant. A fascinating story. Wonderful story. So thank you very much.
That's right. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.